books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwoods, and today we have a history special with Kate Williams on Rival Queens, Lucy Worsley on Jane Austen, plus Andrew Pettigrew and Arthur de Wedewin tell us about the library, A Fragile History, and we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Kate Williams is a best-selling historian, broadcaster, and expert on the royals. In her book, Rival Queens, she reveals how cousins Mary and Elizabeth allied and fought and plotted, but never could escape their bond. A story which inspired the film, Mary, Queen of Scots. Returning to the original letters and archives, Williams creates an electrifying new perspective on their story as they struggled with each other in a male-dominated world, showing the great sacrifices a woman must make to be a queen. Rather than being defeated or tragic, as Mary is often portrayed, Williams reveals instead how she attempted to reinvent queenship and the monarchy in one of the hardest fights in royal history. The audio version of Rival Queens, the portrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots, is available in the RNIB Library as narrated by Emma Cunneth.
I am no longer who I once was, wrote Mary, Queen of Scots, towards the end of her life. Elizabeth and Mary were two queens, ruling one island. One has always been seen as a success, the other often as a failure, at best a tragic queen. But Mary's very act of fighting for her rule should be looked at anew. She tried to rule as a king, and she died for her decisions. Mary set out on life with every possible glory and ended with nothing, her heart taken from her body and secretly buried. And in signing the final act, which condemned her cousin to execution, Elizabeth I lost some of herself. Mary's end meant the death of a small part of all monarchs, for if a queen can be executed, what makes her royal at all?
I was talking about my ninth book, my fifth biography, which is a biography of Mary, Queen of Scots and Elizabeth, Rival Queens, The Betrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots. It wasn't easy. Mary was surrounded by enemies on all sides. I mean, when you look at both of them, Elizabeth, the men around her did undermine her, but they did it by ignoring her or going behind her back. I mean, Mary, they tried to abduct her, to kidnap her, they stabbed her servant, they imprisoned her, anything that they could do to undermine her. So being a woman with power was impossible in many ways. And the big problem for any woman with power came with a husband, because husbands really, in those days, expected to be king and expected to rule over you, and that often annoyed all the other men around you. So it's almost whatever you do, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you get married, you're criticised. If you don't get married, you're criticised. It's not easy.
The life of Mary, Queen of Scots, throws up vital questions about how we think of women and their right to rule. Kings can be autocratic, usually are. But queens give up some power to survive. They must work more closely with ministers, accept the views of others. They are hailed as skilled in compromise and bringing people together, whereas kings are congratulated for deciding, commanding. I have dedicated much study to queens, and it is clear that the progress of the state, the machinery of government, and the power of Parliament moves forward in the reigns of women. Elizabeth could not have had more devoted ministers than William Cecil or Francis Walsingham, but they went behind her back. Victoria is seen as the first post-Reform Act queen, castigated for showing favour to her prime ministers when her predecessors had done worse. and Elizabeth II is hailed as the ultimate constitutional monarch. Perhaps women are uniquely suited for the constitutional role, or perhaps they're simply not given the same latitude as the king.
Women and power, I'm really fascinated by. I'm fascinated by the lives of women in the past, and particularly how women negotiated power, because it was a negotiation in every way. For every monarch, the most powerful woman you've got, and still it's a negotiation, even for Elizabeth II. But for Mary, you see how women can be undermined in the most brutal manner, imprisoned, attacked, assaulted, and finally executed. Mm-hmm. So she does lose everything. So most women just about manage to hold on to their power. They negotiate. They have strategies. Mary, she lost it all.
Mary is seen as misguided. But if we view her in terms of queenship, we can judge her anew based on her attempt to create a successful model for female rule, tolerant, open to incorporating the views of her counsellors, while staking her own claim to ultimate authority. Unfortunately, Mary's lords and ministers tried to turn her into a figurehead, stage coups against her, and her attempts at tolerance collapsed into score settling and murder. But in England, Elizabeth pushed toleration and made it clear she would listen to advisers and achieved great success. Perhaps Mary could have survived the tempest that troubled her reign, but unlike Elizabeth, who played the dance of courtship, Mary married. And she chose the two worst consorts in royal history, men whose failings would inflict lasting damage on her rule.
Now, in your work as a historian, what's the perception of sight loss through the ages?
Well, sight is very important through the ages. It's very important to the Tudor period because they can't really have glasses and you can't really have aids. So sight is absolutely vital, and I do think there are many people whose sight is degenerating, but they won't admit it and they won't talk about it, and it's something actually that I think is sometimes quite hidden in history. But certainly sight is absolutely vital, particularly to a monarch, because they need to read what they're signing, because they can't, if someone reads it to them, they could be lying to them and they could be just putting their signature. Mary, when she was a young girl, signed some blank pieces of paper to please her very power-hungry relations. And in a sense, that's why sight is so important as a monarch, because you can't trust anyone. So if you're signing something, you have to be sure that you're reading it, because of course they didn't have anything as brilliant as Braille in those days. So what they had no choice.
Is it important that your books are available in alternative formats for everyone?
I'm so grateful that my books are available for the blind and partially sighted and print disabled. It's so important to me, and I'm so grateful for what everyone does to create them into these editions. I think it's so vital and so important. It's really thrilling to me that people who can't see can read my books. As an author, I want to write books and to share these amazing worlds, but it doesn't seem fair that they could only be shared with people who are sighted.
Have you ever narrated any of your books?
I have narrated one of my books. I narrated Young Elizabeth. But actually, it's harder than I would have thought, because if you're reading someone else's prose, that's fair enough. You're reading your own prose, you think, oh, I might change that sentence. So it's actually I found it quite difficult. But it's a tough job. And I have to say, I was really in awe of those people who do it, and actors and actresses who get through it in 10 hours and other presenters. It's not easy.
Crowds were cheering outside the house, but for others the monarchy was a hated symbol of privilege and repression, tottering at the top of an unfair system. Britain in 1926 was seized by worker unrest. In the previous spring, mine owners had informed their employees that wages would be lowered and hours increased. The union threatened industrial action. Stanley Baldwin's Conservative government authorised a royal commission into the matter, and it found for the mine owners. The TUC declared a general strike for the 2nd of May, calling out other workers including railway men, printers and dockers. It was a standoff, and they were determined to win. In such turmoil, the advancing pregnancy of the 25-year-old wife of the second son and third child of King George V, Albert Duke of York, was an unwelcome distraction for the Home Secretary, Sir William Joynson Hicks. Called early on the 21st of April, not long before he was due to attend a vital meeting between the Prime Minister and the coal owners. He hurried to the home of the Duchess's parents, 17 Bruton Street, in Mayfair. There, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary was born. He assented to her legitimacy and dashed back to his papers. The King and Queen arrived to visit their first granddaughter. The Princess Royal already had two sons. Queen Mary declared that the child was a little darling with a lovely complexion and pretty hair. The Duke and Duchess were equally happy. "We have long wanted a child to make our happiness complete," the Duke wrote. They had waited 3 years, long by the standards of the time.
Young Elizabeth, written and narrated by Kate Williams, is available commercially. Books by Kate Williams in the RNIB Library include England's Mistress, The Infamous Life of Emma Hamilton, Becoming Queen, Pleasures of Men, Josephine, Desire, Ambition, Napoleon, The Storms of War, and a novel called The Happiness Machine, alongside Rival Queens, The Betrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for several years now. I can't actually remember when I started. I think over the years I've done quite a range of books, but very often I seem to get ones that are quite weighty for whatever reason. When I say quite weighty, I suppose I think of that because I've had things like The Island Race by Winston Churchill, The Condition of the Working Class in England by Engels, and Mein Kampf, Unabridged, which was a challenge. One of the books I really enjoyed was The Monk Cardinal, Basil Hume biography by Anthony Howard, because that was a fascinating portrait of a man and a world that I knew nothing about, all the sort of background to the internal politics of the Catholic Church, and this amazing portrait of this very remarkable man, and I found that a great book to do. Basil Hume served as Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster for 23 years, and his holiness and wisdom made him an extraordinary leader. In this biography, Anthony Howard, who has had unique access to Cardinal Hume's private papers and the people who knew him best, traces his life from his Newcastle upbringing through to his schooling at Ampleforth and his reign at Westminster, including his long and ultimately successful fight on behalf of the Maguire 7 and the Guildford 4. I got to know about RNIB Talking Books years ago when I was still a child, and my late grandmother in her final years had been an avid reader all her life. She devoured books all the time, and I hear stories like this all the time, but she lost most of her sight towards the end of her life and greatly enjoyed getting the old, I think, 8-track cartridges and the machine that you fitted them into to continue listening to books, some ones she'd read before, some that were new to her. And I think that was the first time I became aware that this was something that wasn't just providing books for people to listen to randomly, but that it was a very valuable service. It's very nice to know as well that sometimes you're recording books that aren't going to be given a commercial release, that are just being recorded for the RNIB, and making what are often amazing books much more widely available than they would be. So I think I'm very fortunate to be doing these sort of recordings, and I think it's a lovely thing to read for the RNIB.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come, the library, a fragile history, some books in the RNIB library, but first, Lucy Worsley is a historian and presenter well known to those who enjoy history documentaries on the TV or radio. As a curator of the Royal Palaces, she also has a keen interest in what buildings reveal about those who lived in them. And this interest lies at the heart of our biography of Jane Austen, called Jane Austen at Home. The audio version is read by Ruth Redman.
To generations of Austen worshippers, the site of Steventon Rectory is hallowed ground. They are often to be found at the side of the lane, silent and thoughtful, peering through the hedge into the Hampshire field where it stood. This is the place where she spent 25 years and wrote 3 novels. This is where it all began. Anyone who reads Jane Austen's novels closely will notice that although we have a picture in our minds of Pemberley or Trafalgar House in Sanditon or Donwell Abbey, the details she actually gives us are very sparse. She sketches an outline. Our minds then fill it in. But the houses Jane describes in the most detail are always parsonages. In Mansfield Park, for example, we get a much fuller physical description of Edmund Bertram's future home in his parish than we do of the great mansion of Mansfield Park itself. That's because parsonages mattered to Jane. She often visited great houses and was familiar with places like Pemberley, but Jane was most at home in a parsonage like the one she knew from growing up with her parents and brothers and sister in the Hampshire countryside. And yet, to work out what her real home, Steventon Rectory, was like, takes time, patience and imagination, because the house itself is gone.
Ruth Redman reading Jane Austen at Home by Lucy Worsley. And Lucy told our reporter Claire Carson all about it at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
It's called Jane Austen at Home, and the clue is in the title. It's about the different places, the different buildings in which she lived. And if you've seen feature films about Jane Austen's, well, of Jane Austen's novels, you might have the idea that she lived in magnificent mansions. But that isn't the case at all. She lived in a succession of sometimes quite small, sometimes rather depressing houses, a rented flat. And I went and visited all of these places because I think that once you know this, you can get a new understanding of her books, of her novels.
The story of the Austens at Steventon Rectory really begins in the late summer of 1768, when a wagon, heavily loaded with household goods, made its way through the Hampshire lanes from nearby Dean to the village of Steventon. Its members had no notion that so many historians and biographers would scrutinise this ordinary event in the life of an ordinary family. Although Mr. George Austen, 38, and his wife Cassandra, 29, had only been married for 4 years, their household was not inconsiderable. It included Mrs. Austen's own mother, Mrs. Jane Lee, and the couple's 3 boys, James, Jemmy, George, and Edward, Neddy, the latter less than 1 year old. There would also have been maids and manservants of name and number unknown. They probably included Jane Lee's servant, Mary Ellis. Although it was only a short distance of just over a mile from Dean to Steventon, their wagon crept slowly along a road that was a mere cart track, so cut up by deep ruts as to be impassable for a light carriage. The village of Steventon was deep in the countryside, difficult to reach if the rough country lanes were muddy. Indeed, many a coachman would not take you. Once, a member of the Austen family travelling by carriage near Steventon called out to his driver to hurry up and get on with it. "I do get on, sir, where I can," came the answer. "You stupid fellow," was the response. "Any fool can do that. I want you to get on where you can't."
Tell us how you became involved in Jane Austen.
Well, I'm a historian of things. There are historians who work primarily from documents and written sources, but I've always really liked the way that food or clothes or music or architecture can act like a little wormhole to take you back into the past, the nitty-gritty, dirty detail, if you like, of people's lives. And my real job, what I actually do all day, is work as a museum curator. I'm the chief curator at Historic Royal Palaces. So we look after grand royal palaces, but I've always been a complete Jane Austen lover as well. I thought I could use my approach as an architectural historian to her life, and I just had the best time doing it.
What was one of the most interesting things that you found out about her?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin, really. I had a sense of this, but I didn't really understand just how financially precarious her life was. So I'm not saying that she lived a life of struggle for food or anything like that. No, she wasn't on the streets. But her family came from a level of society that's called the pseudo-gentry. I quite like this term. It means you want to be part of the landed gentry, but you don't actually have any land. So there's a certain amount of make-do and mend and keeping up appearances. And at this level in society, it's inappropriate for women to earn money. You weren't supposed to just go out and get a job as a woman. You were supposed to marry money, which is something that Jane didn't do. And I think that one of the reasons that she didn't do it is because she thought she could glimpse that maybe it was possible for her to make her living as a professional writer, that she was just beginning to do when, at the age of 41, she died. It's utterly tragic.
But it is interesting that she was going against that which was expected of her. So from the films, like you say, we've got a picture that she's living a charmed life in a big house. But the reality is that she was very hardworking and chose to live in a small cottage and work hard and not marry. Tell us a bit more about her relationships.
Well, the crunch moment came when she was approaching what she herself calls the years of danger. So, right, when you're 27, when you're 28, if you're a Georgian spinster in the gentry, you're getting really worried. You're just about to get left on the shelf. And when she's at this age, she did panic and she did sort of accept a very good offer from a man who had a proper mansion. He was kind of like Mr. Darcy, but obviously he didn't have Mr. Darcy's kind, redeeming, talented, clever, brilliant qualities. And the next morning she woke up again and she thought, no, I just can't go through with this. And she broke it all off. So that's the point at which I think she thought, that life which is expected for me, I'm going to turn down.
Very courageous.
Very courageous. And she ended up instead living with her sister, who, like her, was unmarried. And they had to live on little gifts, little handouts from their brothers who were working. They were clergymen, they were in the navy, one of them was a sort of landed gentleman, and so they were living on the charity of their brothers in a little cottage. That there they had freedom, and there I think Jane had creative freedom, and that's where she got on and she produced her late great books, which are Mansfield Park and Emma and Persuasion. And I think that there's an underlying message in all of these books, which are on the surface really beautiful, frothy, pleasurable, life-enhancing romances. But underneath, the books say, isn't it terrible that women are put into this position where they have to marry money? That's my belief.
Mr. George Austen was a man of many cares, an ill wife, a dying mother-in-law, and his second son George suffering from fits. Not least among his worries was his financial situation. The records of Mr. Austen's account at Hawes Bank in London show that on the 6th of August, he had sold stock worth more than £250, presumably for the expenses of bringing the new house up to a habitable standard. This sum of money represented nearly a year's income for him. Mr. Austen had, in fact, been in charge of the parish of Steventon for the last 4 years, but he had found his rectory there so run down and dilapidated, of the most miserable description, that he and his family had been living instead in a rented house in the neighbouring village of Dean. This building was hardly any better, a low, damp place with small, inconvenient rooms and scarcely two on the same level. The pokey parsonage at Dean was about the size of a coach, its various rooms, the coach box, basket and dickey, the box being the seat at the front for the driver, the dickey being the seat at the back for servants. In 1764, the year George and Cassandra had married and moved to Hampshire, there had been great rains at Dean. The wells in the parish rose to their tops, and fish were taken between the parsonage yard and the road. The other freak of nature to be seen in George and Dean was its enormous cabbages. A neighbour grew one 5 feet in circumference in the solid part, and which weighs upwards of 32 pounds. Meanwhile, down the lane in the neighbouring parish of Steventon, the high winds of February had blown down the church's timber steeple. It was an inauspicious beginning. Indeed, when the future Mrs. Austen had visited Hampshire to take a look at the county in which she was to live, She had found it unattractive compared with the broad river, the rich valley, and the noble hills which she had been accustomed to behold at her native home near Henley-upon-Thames.
So she was possibly quite hard up through her life. Did she have any sense, do you think, that her books would be so successful?
You've got to define hard up quite carefully, because she was never hungry. Her concerns were more like having the right thing to wear, having the freedom to spend her time as she wished, because it was expected that she would spend a lot of time, A, looking for a husband, B, sucking up to rich people who might give her legacies, C, acting as a childminder for her 33 nieces and nephews, which she had, because obviously if you've got a maiden aunt, well, you get her to look after the kids, don't you? So she had those kind of restrictions on her life. And this pseudo-gentry thing was one of the reasons that when she did publish her books, she was successful later on in her life. Her name wasn't on the cover because her family, you know, they weren't totally comfortable with this. So by the time she died, nobody knew who Jane Austen was. She never saw the financial benefits of her brilliance, although she was starting to get a bit of money in.
And made something like £600 through her life?
Yes, her lifetime earnings were in the region of £650. Now, what does that mean? It was quite a lot compared with what she'd had before, which was pocket money that her family gave her of £20 a year. She had to live on that, £20 a year. So 650 sounds like a lot. But when I tell you that for a Georgian professional man, like a solicitor, he would have expected to earn £650 in 6 months.
So how amazing that she is on the £10 note. Now, there is a wonderful fact about the £10 note that RNIB was consulted when the note was made so that it would be very accessible and understandable. And the third £10 note ever produced with Jane Austen's face on went to RNIB. First was the Queen, then the Prime Minister, then RNIB. So it's very precious, although even the image that we see on that, I understand, isn't quite possibly the right one.
May I say, I'm delighted she's on the £10 note. I'm really happy that she's there. But there is a sort of delicious irony that I think maybe she herself would have appreciated, which is that picture that's on the note isn't really her.
Scandal!
Well, it is what we would call a sort of airbrushed author publicity photo. That's what it is. It was produced after she was dead. She didn't have any say in it. And people who knew her looked at it and they said, yes, that's a sweet and pleasing face, but it's really not much like the original.
And wow, interesting.
The original, as far as we can tell, does survive through a sketch that her sister made of her. And in it, you've just got a less pretty face. You've got someone who looks, sometimes she's described as looking a little bit sour in the picture. And I do think she was a very funny, sharp, clever, sometimes bitter person. The sort of person who could have a good laugh about what's happened.
Some of her books took a long time to write, possibly even 10 or 20 years in the making. Can you help us understand why that was?
She had an interesting journey towards getting published. She started out writing to entertain her family. She had all these brothers and a sister. They lived in the countryside. There wasn't much to do in the evenings. So she would write stories and read them aloud to the group. And that's why Jane Austen novels sound really good. The dialogue in them is really good. They're like plays. It's one of the reasons that people find them easy to turn into films, because it's all about what the characters are saying to each other. So you can imagine her performing these stories to her family and honing them over time. And her father, who was a great supporter, when she was in her 20s, he sent off one of these books to a publisher who just turned it down flat. Now, that was kind of a boon, because she didn't, you know, we don't even know that she knew that he'd done this, actually. But either way, nothing came of it, but she went on trying and getting better. So if that early version of her work had been published, she might not have the reputation that she's got today, because she went on reworking that book until it reached its sort of mature form, and then it did come into the world after a long, hard slog on her part. And I think that the reasons that publishers couldn't see what was good about her books at first is because they were so unlike everybody else's books. There weren't any pirates in them. There weren't any ghosts or haunted abbeys. They were just they were so novel. They really were novels. They were entirely novel. And that's why it took ages for publishers to see what was good about them. Discerning readers saw what was good about them. But the whole thing did not catch fire until years after she was dead.
Here, her father enjoyed a comfortable life as a clergyman, employed by an Oxford college. Hampshire, by contrast, presented a miserable prospect. The poverty of the soil in most places prevents the timber from attaining a large size. Mr. Austin's new parish, or living, would scarcely provide him with income enough from tithes to make such a life as his wife had been used to. The couple had met in the sophisticated surroundings of Oxford, possibly in the house of Cassandra's uncle, the master of Balliol College. Marriage to the delicate Cassandra Lee, as she was then, must have been a slightly daunting prospect. She was a gifted writer and a member of an old, prosperous, rambling family, the Lees of Warwickshire. Her father had been a Fellow of All Souls before becoming an Oxfordshire rector. Her uncle, Dr. Theophilus Lee, was the master of Balliol for more than 50 years, a chatty man, overflowing with puns and witticisms and sharp retorts. He was rather taken with his niece's own quickness and inventiveness, naming her as the poet of the family, and a writer promising a great genius. People later thought that Mrs. Austin, rather than her husband, must have bequeathed Jane her talent, for she possessed the germ of much of the ability which was concentrated in her younger daughter.
I love the image of everyone gathering round, you know, the dark evenings, the fire burning, the candles burning, to hear the stories read aloud. It's something magnificent about storytelling that possibly we lose a bit. Would that have been very typical of her age?
Well, I think it's kind of like, you know, today we sit in the room, there's a television in the corner. So one person on the television is entertaining numerous people through the technology that's available. They were just doing the same thing. One person would entertain the rest through the... And the price of candles actually comes into this. A lot of life comes down to funny little nitty-gritty details of domestic life. If you were pseudo-gentry, like the Austins were, you would not want to burn a lot of candles at night because they were expensive. So you'd light just one and one person would read and the others would sit in the dark and listen. And it was frugal.
So how did Jane Austen become so famous if her name wasn't on the cover of the book and people didn't really even know who she was until she died?
Well, after she died, her family thought, we're pseudo-gentry, we need some cash, what can we do? So they brought out in a sort of collected edition the novels that she'd published and the ones that she hadn't. And this is the first time her name was on the cover, and then it just grew from there, really.
Why do you think that Jane Austen is still so popular today?
Now, Jane Austen's Victorian readers, these are the people who first really took her to their hearts. They like to think of her as a good little woman, somebody called Saint Aunt Jane, who lived in a village and put together these nice little stories. And this is an image that's stuck, and it's an image that is wrong. If you just look at the physical form of her manuscripts, a little bit of her novel writing, a lot of her letter writing, you can see that it's messy and it's passionate and she goes over things. It's sometimes as if she's yelling on the paper. And today what people look for and find in Jane Austen is someone much more like us, somebody who cares, somebody who wants to be professional, somebody who wants to make money out of their writing. And the great thing about Jane Austen is that every generation comes along and they look at her work, and it is so infinitely flexible that they find themselves in it. In 10 years, somebody else will be saying, no, 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 you've got Jane Austen all wrong. She was like this. This is my Jane Austen.
Do you have a favourite character?
Well, I particularly like the story of Emma, which is it's quite an unpopular Jane Austen book because the heroine is a bit difficult to like. There's something a bit prickly about her. She's quite a proud person. I can't think at all why I like her. Obviously, she and I have nothing in common with each other.
Well, Lucy, thank you so much for talking to us. And I'm sure that Emma would have made a great historian.
She might have done, yeah. She had a very inquiring mind and she was very good at leaping to conclusions, which is a danger for a historian.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
In London, she wrote, everyone was always rushing about. 'Tis a sad place. I would not live in it on any account. One has not time to do one's duty, either to God or man. But there were some changes. Mrs. Austin's mother was right to suspect at the time of the move to the new house that she was very ill indeed. She survived arrival for only a few days. She was replaced, though, by even more children, come to join their brothers in rolling down the green slope. Henry was born in 1771. In 1773 came the first girl, named Cassandra, for her mother. "He was sorry to hear of it," wrote Mr. Austin's gloomy brother-in-law, "for Mr. and Mrs. Austin will find it easier to get a family than to provide for them." In Hampshire, though, his advice was ignored, for next, in 1774, came Francis, or Frank, and then came Jane.
Thanks to Claire Carson and, of course, Lucy Worsley. Jane Austen at Home is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, as is If Walls Could Talk, A History of the Home. Both books are also available in Braille. And of course, all of Jane Austen's novels are available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats. You can head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Still to come, we'll hear about the library, a fragile history. But now, let's hear some brand new books in the RNIB Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. In Nigeria by Michael Palin was donated by Penguin Random House.
I always thought there would come a time when it would feel right and sensible to hang up my boots, to start taking it easy, to surrender to all those books stacked up beside me over the years, their bright and beguiling covers shouting, "Read me!" To visit, at long last, all those good friends who've invited me to come and stay, on clifftops or beside Scottish lochs or in cathedral closes. My 80th birthday seemed to be that moment. After all, at 80, time is not on your side. You're entering the decade of falling over, of asking people to speak up, and of querying the whereabouts of public toilets. Insurance companies, doctors, and very often your own family, suggest it might be best to stay indoors more. Beware, they say, the world outside is confused and unstable, meaning just like you. The trouble is that I, like many entering their ninth decade, feel a sudden surge of delight and irresponsibility. We've got to 80, goddammit! That's halfway to immortality. We don't all feel cowed and oppressed. Some of us feel skittish and silly, and determined to behave as if we were 27 again.
Brimming with wry humour and fascinating insights, this is a vivid and varied portrait of a complex country. With his 80th birthday looming, it crossed Michael Palin's mind that now might be the time to hang up his boots, to lounge about at home, to take things easy. Then the opportunity to visit Africa's most populous nation arose. In the journal he kept during his trip, he gives a vivid account of the towns and cities he visited, the landscapes he travelled through, and the people he met. Michael Palin is welcomed as an honoured guest by a powerful emir and harangued by a passerby in Benin City. He hears the testimony of a kidnapped victim of the terrorist group Boko Haram and experiences the collective spiritual ecstasy of one of Nigeria's megachurches. And throughout his trip, he experiences at first hand the contradictions of a country that has so much natural wealth and human talent, yet simultaneously grapples with corruption, religious strife, and deep inequality.
One of the greatest gifts bestowed on me in the course of my life has been to be taken to see the world, camera crew in tow, and to be able to share my experiences on my return. Difficult and dangerous as those travels have sometimes been, they seem to satisfy an area of myself which acting and writing comedy have never touched. I would describe travelling as total experience. It can include, often more than you might think, both comedy and acting, while at the same time offering an almost daily change of scene and circumstance to respond to. Highs and lows, blazing sunsets, mighty waterfalls, relics of ancient civilizations, but also death and destruction and hunger and disease. For the true traveller, there should be no compromise. There should be no hiding away from how the world really is. If you're genuinely curious, as I am, you want to see everything that's going on out there, not just what's going well, but what should be going well but isn't. Which is a way of explaining why I've recently been drawn to countries like North Korea and Iraq. Both are nations with long and distinguished histories. They're also nations that have suffered terribly. Seeing at first hand how and why things have gone so wrong for them, and what they're doing to address the problems they face, is an education. And this is what drives me to keep my boots on. I will never have seen enough, but I want to keep trying. Travel is an addictive process, and one that I realized after my return from Iraq I wanted to continue. Fortunately, so too did the team I travelled with, and so did the good people at Channel 5 and ITN Productions. I sat down with my director, Neil Ferguson, to try and identify another country less visited. Nigeria came to both our minds.
In Nigeria is written and read by Michael Palin and runs for 2 hours 44 minutes.
The Book of Birds, A Field Guide to Wonder and Loss by Robert McFarlane was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Nest is secrecy. Nest is rest. Nest is sanctuary, fastness, absence of fear. Nest is bowl, sphere, burrow, hole or cradle. Nest is white stalks, bristling cauldron of sticks and soil on a church's steeple. Nest is skylarks hollow in a wildflower meadow, or lapwing scrape in a pylon shadow. Nest happens far from human eyes, and nest lives hard by people. Nest is blessed. Nest is ingenuity, intricacy, improvisation. Nest is wren's ball, pure cocoon. Nest is starling's mess, all twigs and yarn and tidy as a teenager's room. Nest is 4 glowing blue robin eggs, tucked in a boot in the daytime dusk of a cobweb barn. Nest is bowbird's bling and dazzle. Nest is flamingo's urn of sunburned clay. Nest is a gerfalcon eyrie, used yearly, since long before the Roman Empire faded away. Nest is 3 swallow chicks, packed snug in a cup of mud above a farmhouse door.
A great thinning of the skies is underway. Around 50% of bird species are in decline worldwide. Our dawns and springs are quieter each year than last. An almost unimaginable abundance has been lost. It does not have to be this way, but we will not save what we do not love. The Book of Birds is a compendium of 49 bird species, all of which are declining or endangered in Britain. Inspired by the classic bird books with which the author grew up, this is a field guide with a difference. It asks not what is that bird, but who is that bird. It shows its readers how to identify birds, but also how to identify with them. With lyrical precision and playfulness, Robert McFarlane evokes each bird's habits and habitats, their patterns of flight and of song, how they hunt and gather, how they nest and raise their young, the stories and myths that which attend them, the threats which shadow them, and how their wild lives intersect with our own.
Bullfinch, Pirilla Pirilla. plump little bullfinch, plumbird, bulldog, perched among the orchard branches, plucking at the buds. Pink little bullfinch, lumbudder, blood ulp, puffing out your salmon chest and swaying as you sing. Burly little bullfinch, staunch neck, stout beak, piping out your creaky notes there amid the blossom. Ripe rosy bullfinch, crisp apple, bright bauble, lighting up the winter trees, calling in the frost. Bullfinch, you rarely flock. You're wary and secretive, you're hard to spot. You're the match in the mantle, the second look, the key in the lock. No wonder you hide. For centuries a bounty lay on your black-capped head, and each year you were killed in your thousands for stripping the flowers of plum and pear, cox and russet, cherry and peach before the fruit could set. In the orchard counties, children hunted you for pennies. Catapult and airgun, stick trap and lime, took your wings as proof and left your bodies there like windfall, rotting on the ground. In richer houses, they kept you caged, imprisoned for your plumage and your haunting, husky song. Your captors played you melodies in the hope you'd learn them and sing along. The orchards you love are vanishing now, half of them lost in 100 years, surviving as street names in new estates, or hand-drawn maps in the pages of dusty books. These days we're lucky to glimpse a pair of you, bullfinch. Pyrrhula, pyrrhula, from the Greek word for flame. A lick, a tongue, a flicker of pink fire in the green, occasionally, thrillingly, implausibly seen.
The Book of Birds by Robert McFarlane is read by Robert McFarlane with Jackie Morris and runs for 3 hours and 39 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And talking of libraries, famed across the known world, jealously guarded by private collectors, built up over centuries, destroyed in a single day, ornamented with gold leaf and frescoes, or filled with beanbags and children's drawings. The history of the library is rich, varied, and stuffed full of incident.
Today, public libraries face falling budgets and the maintenance costs of old and decaying buildings, at the same time as demands for new services and declining interest in their legacy collections. During our research for this book, we witnessed at first hand the struggle over the Durning Public Library in Kennington, which Lambeth Council planned to turn into a community resource. Council speak for defunding it and allowing it to be run by volunteers. This ran into determined resistance from a group of local residents campaigning to keep it open. Does the campaign represent public-spirited altruism that we should applaud? Or is it a nostalgia for a world that has now disappeared and will never return?
In this, the first major history of its kind, Andrew Pettigrew and Arthur de Verivin explore the contested and dramatic history of the library. From the famous collections of the ancient world to the embattled public resources we cherish today.
Well, hello, I'm Arthur de Verivin. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of St Andrews and I'm a historian and writer.
I'm Andrew Pettigrew. I'm a professor of modern history at the University of St Andrews, and together with Arthur, I've written The Library of Fragile History.
The educated and affluent part of our community takes it for granted that public funding of the arts and the facilitation of recreational reading is part of the core functions of government. But the public library, in the sense of a funded collection available free to anyone who wants to use it, has only existed since the mid-19th century. A mere fraction of the history of the library as a whole. If there is one lesson from the centuries-long story of the library, it is that libraries only last as long as people find them useful.
It's a history of libraries and book collecting from ancient Greece to Google. So we cover a lot of ground in our 18 chapters, but it's been a very interesting project because I think we've demonstrated that although most histories of libraries concentrate on beautiful buildings and great collections. It's actually been private libraries, personal collecting, which has really driven the story of book collecting.
Today, are libraries under threat?
They certainly are, but I think the point of us writing this book, the story that we wanted to tell, is to frame the current crises of libraries, funding cuts, closures, even the pandemic we're going through right now, to frame that in a much longer history of library crises. In fact, the library as a concept has always in some way been under threat.
In the book, you describe collections being destroyed. Is that heartbreaking when you find out about these?
Well, there's been a lot of books which have described the bombing of libraries and the destruction of libraries. And of course, these are individual tragedies. But far more destruction goes on through the mundane process of libraries weeding their stock each year to provide space. Libraries are created, they're enhanced, and then they're dispersed and recreated elsewhere. And it's that everyday story of evolution that we've concentrated on most in our book.
In other words, libraries need to adapt to survive, as they have always adapted to survive, a feat very successfully accomplished in recent years in France with its network of médiathèques, albeit with a huge commitment of public funds. University libraries, responding to student demand, are now social hubs as much as places of work. The cathedral silence that once characterized the library, a thing of the past. In this, libraries actually hark back to an earlier model, pioneered in the Renaissance, when libraries were often convivial social spaces in which books jostled for attention alongside paintings, sculptures, coins, and curiosities. This history of libraries does not offer a story of easy progress through the centuries, nor a prolonged lament for libraries lost. A repeating cycle of creation and dispersal, decay and reconstruction, turns out to be the historical norm.
The people who work in libraries are usually female, but the person at the top's usually male. Has it always been that sort of a sexist industry?
For a very long time, the staff of libraries was exclusively male, especially for great institutional libraries. If you're thinking here, for example, of libraries in monasteries, in the early universities, these were very much male domains. So you really see the rise of the sort of the feminization of the library at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And yes, there has certainly been the case that the hierarchy within those libraries has often been warped, like you described. Like the top administrators are male, but the vast majority of the actual staff are female. But women have, in that role, exercised enormous influence over readers and borrowers in the library. You don't necessarily need to be right at the top of the leadership in order to be able to have a meaningful influence on the collections.
And I would say that it is very different in different countries. The United States was much quicker than Great Britain to feminize its profession. And if you go to France now, 80% of the staff of the municipal libraries are now women, but so are most of the directors. So that's a profession in France where women have risen absolutely to the top of the profession.
Now, if there was a library you could visit that's no longer with us, what one would it be?
Well, I think out of sure sort of emotional attachment, and one of the things that you described earlier about the sadness of destruction of libraries, I would have loved to have visited one of the sort of the great Polish libraries before the Second World War and in the interwar period. Because I think when you're talking about the deliberate destruction of libraries, it's in the Second World War with the Nazi destruction of the cultural heritage of Central and Eastern Europe that you see sort of the greatest crime against books. So to just walk around those collections and see books which almost all of them were entirely destroyed, we've lost so much there that would be a real privilege to be able to see that and take something in.
I think I'd take the auction catalogue of one of the Dutch libraries of the 17th century, and I'd go back 300 years and then knock on the door and ask to see where this person was keeping 2,000 books in an ordinary townhouse, because very few private libraries survive as they were experienced by their owners. But in the case of the Dutch, there are an awful lot of auction catalogues which give you a sort of second-hand view, but they don't tell us anything about where they kept their books.
Even if libraries are cherished, The contents of these collections require constant curation and often painful decisions about what is continuing value and what must be disposed of. Very often libraries flourished in the hands of their first owner and then wasted away. Damp, dust, moths, and bookworm do far more damage over the years than the targeted destruction of libraries. But while growth and decline are parts of the cycle, so too is recovery. In 1556, the University of Oxford, its book collection despoiled, sold off the library's furniture. 50 years later, Sir Thomas Bodley established the greatest university library of the next 3 centuries. Fire ravaged libraries with remarkable frequency, only for the collections to be rebuilt more easily with each passing generation, as the number of books available on the open market multiplied. This is a story, then, of many unexpected twists and turns.
The Library, A Fragile History, and it picks up of this theme we've running through it of how vulnerable libraries are, but they always bounce back. Mm. And very unusually, Profile, our publishers, wrote to us to ask who we'd like to do the audiobook. And they gave us the sample of 3 different people's work so that we could choose between them. And frankly, as an author, you very seldom get that sort of consideration from publishers. But it's Sean Barrett, who's our reader. And I have to say that he's got a most beautiful voice. And I'm sure he's done a good job. When I spoke to our publisher about this and said, thank you for asking, I said, they do get trouble because sometimes authors say they want to do it themselves without realising just what a difficult job it is to do.
So you didn't fancy reading it yourself?
No, certainly not. And I think given we've got co-authorship on this book, we had such a fun time writing it together. But I think if we both had to read it, you know, who knows what conflict might arise.
The Library, A Fragile History by Arthur de Vedevin and Andrew Pettigrew is available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.